Good morning. Call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water for Tuesday. Where are we at already? The 9th? Tuesday? February 9th? I should know that. It's my anniversary, my sister's birthday, plans for tonight, and all that good stuff. First, we have I think we may take these in close to order. We will begin with a public hearing on House Bill 3693, and let's have a couple of folks. Actually, Beth, do you want to say anything about the bill, since this is not something we've discussed yet as a committee?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3693-1, which you should have in front of you, authorizes the sale of diesel fuel that otherwise meets the requirements of the state's biodiesel fuel standards, but to which substances have been added to prevent congealing or gelling of biodiesel fuel. The provision applies to fuel sold or offered for sale from October 1 of any year to February 28th of the following year, and the provision sunsets on March 1st, 2011.
Okay, thank you, Beth. I'll have... take this in two panels. We have five folks signed up. If you've arrived late and would like to testify, please let staff know. And let's begin. It looks like we have one person here for more than 100 miles, so we'll make sure you get up. Devin Diaz. And we'll just go up from the bottom. Devin, Katie Fast, John Ledger. Start with the three of you.
Good morning. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. The Farm Bureau is in support of House Bill 3693 with the Dash 1 amendments. Maybe some background on the issue is this past winter, especially during that first week in December when we had the cold spell, there were gelling issues in eastern Oregon, and the thought is it's related to the 2% biodiesel that was put in the statute last session. The Department of Agriculture had numerous complaints related to the gelling issue. Some of those were from my members. We had situations where ranchers going out to feed cattle in the morning had their tractors not starting. There were issues in the city of Bend with school buses not starting during that week. This legislation would allow additives from either a chemical additive to prevent gelling or kerosene, which is traditionally added to diesel to prevent gelling and make it winterized, allow those to be added to the 2% blend of biodiesel, which might dilute the 2% down a bit, but it would allow commerce and transportation to continue. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Katie. Go ahead, Mr. Ledger.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I'll be very brief. Just to reiterate Katie's comments, this is something that affected numerous of our members, and we're very pleased, Mr. Chairman, to see it come before the committee, and we thank you for that and the committee, and also the people who worked on this. We think they did a very good job, and I'll leave further discussions up to them, and we hope the bill passes out.
Thank you. Mr. Ledger, affected numerous of your members. Who and how?
We have agricultural members and members that operate fleets of trucks, and it's a very similar problem with the gelling and concern, and we think this will go a long way to solving that.
Okay, and Ms. Fast, I see a question over here before Representative Barnhart. Ms. Fast, a little more character on who's been affected by this?
The complaints I had were related around the ranching community with tractors, and then also pickup trucks that are diesel that didn't start during this time.
Yep. Representative Barnhart?
Can you give us a sense? Did you get information from your members about what temperatures we're talking about? I assume this is a temperature-related problem.
So, Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart, I think the majority of the complaints came during that first, second week of December, where the temperatures in eastern Oregon were, you know, anywhere, I think the highs were 5 to 0 into the negatives. And the Department of Agriculture, I know, is in the room, and they compiled some reports and might be able to give some more detailed information about the complaints that they received during that winter time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Is the department available to testify? They're not on the sheet, but it might be helpful to hear. I don't know that the department has a position on the bill, but it might be helpful to hear a little bit more about the complaints that you received and the problem as you see it. We have a switch here and have the Mr. Henderson.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I do have kind of a quick summary of the complaints that we did receive. They were from the time period December 8th through December 30th. That is when that cold spell hit Oregon. We received 19 complaints, 10 in Klamath Falls, 4 in Bend in the Redmond area, 2 in the Hines Burns area, 1 in the Dalles, 1 in Baker City, and 1 in Ontario. Most of those were gelling issues between the minus 10 and 20, minus 25 range, so it was cold. It was gelling fuel as well as clogged filters, which is something that happens when it gets really cold. The filters, especially if they've got small lines that go to them, those will plug up. We did, in response to that, send our staff out and collected samples, fuel samples, to try to figure out was the fuel not of the right quality or was it just cold? And really, in summary, it was just cold. The fuel tested out to the ASTM standards where it should be. I think the issues that we have here in Oregon, and we have had some conversations with the state of Minnesota, who has a lot of experience in this area. Their biodiesel mandate went into effect about 5 years ago. Their first year of their implementation, they had these same types of issues and actually have a scientific board that they put together to try to help put all the things together to help, I think, consumers as well as those doing the blending figure out what the right recipe is. With that, answer any questions you have. If you get too over my head, I'll have to ask my helpers to come up.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. So is the issue more with the methodology in the blending as opposed to an issue that is inherent to having 2% biodiesel in the fuel?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, in the information that we've received is it's not one single thing. It's not just the biodiesel. It's all of those things. I think one thing that Minnesota has stressed is that there needs to be a clear communication between the customer and their distributor of the fuel on what their expectations is for the cold fuel properties. In Minnesota, that's easier to do because it's colder for a longer period of time. Oregon, unfortunately, doesn't have these cold spells very often, and it's expensive to add these additives. And so our information says it's not just the blend. It's how it's blended and getting it right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that we are talking about adding substances to a fuel that prevent cold weather gelling, and that this is a process that has happened prior to the 2% biodiesel standard, then that would lead me to assume that perhaps there are gelling issues with diesel, regardless of whether or not there's a biodiesel content at certain cold temperatures. Is that correct?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, when it gets this cold, you're going to have gelling issues. I think one thing that we found in talking with folks as we started making calls is the once you receive the B2 blend, and then if you were to resell that, you couldn't add anything to it to help your customers, and so people got stuck. And so they were left with a blend that couldn't meet these gelling issues, but couldn't blend anything to it because then they would be in violation of the standard. And that's one thing that we did here that was preventing people from kind of compensating for the cold.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a little struck by one of your comments about how cold it gets in the Midwest, and we don't get that here. And I realize that Oregon has a fairly mild climate by many comparisons. I grew up in a much colder climate than it is here, and am reasonably familiar with the phenomenon of Kelvin. However, in the same period of time that you were getting these complaints coming in from around the state, I had an exactly similar complaint, which I didn't bring forth because it was something I was more or less familiar with. But on a long weekend, I spent some time with some friends up in the mountain on the Lostine River, and I, or creek, if you would have it. And I'd submit that it gets fairly cold up in Wallowa County, which is part of the state of Oregon, I think. although I do believe they tried to secede at some times, and probably still wish sometimes that they could, but, you know, be all of that as it may. I have a diesel pickup, and when I went out in the morning to start it, it did start, and it would run, but only at an idle. I couldn't get enough power out of it to get it out of the driveway, sort of thing, until I let it sit and run for quite some time. And the engine motor got everything warmed up, and we went on down the way. So I think in discussing this with some of the people in the industry, that it's a matter of finding the right additives, if you wish, to the biodiesel, and it's not necessarily, as you indicate, something wrong with the biodiesel in and of itself. So I do think we have to pay some attention to the cold, because there are parts of our state that get real cold. If you catch the weather forecasts, and looking at places like Meacham and that type of thing, there are many sub-zero weather there, and there are a lot of rigs that are using the biodiesel all of them are using the mixture that we have, and it does potentially represent some real hardship or conflict. But thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question anymore.
Let the record reflect that it does get very cold in parts of Oregon.
That's true. Seldom, very seldom are we able to compete with international falls in Minnesota, but excluding a few places like that, we do have some cool weather in this state. And
Absolutely. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So as I understand it, this bill is only for a year, so we can sort of figure out what to do next, is my understanding. We learned anything already from Minnesota that might instruct us in that year, and could we put some of that on the record? Like, what's the, what's the answer? What are the possible answers?
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, we're just now kind of looking at what Minnesota's done. They actually have done a report for their legislature that I think actually is a good guide. The Biodiesel Board has also put out a guide for the market itself, and I think there's going to be a learning curve in this, and I think we're in that right now.
Okay. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very familiar with the issue. I had at least a dozen ranchers, farmers, and other folks call regarding the challenges that cold weather presented, and I contacted Department of Agriculture, and I was happy to see the department jump in to try to figure out what to do. I want to share with the committee a challenge that we face in Eastern Oregon, and it has to do with the source of this biodiesel, because our source generally is Idaho, and we bring our fuel out of Idaho, or the price being different, it can be pulled out of the Tri-City area by truck. So we have basically two sources, and by playing those two sources against each other, we could keep our price of diesel fuel down. That opportunity was removed by virtue of this law. And as a result, if we were going to get appropriately mixed diesel fuel, it would have to come from Portland. and that added additional freight costs dramatically, additional, like 20 cents, and no longer could we pull it out of Boise because we didn't have a way of mixing it. It happens that one of the local jobbers is building a facility in Ontario to mix this bio-element into diesel fuel. It doesn't mean that he will reduce the price down to that which we previously got it. I doubt it, being a good business person, that he would do such a thing. But I think at least it would be available. But I want everyone to understand that this is expensive for Eastern Oregon because we don't have a multitude of sources competing to drive down the cost of diesel fuel. So once you add that additional, it can be as much as 40 cents more expensive, just so everybody understands. By virtue of this new law. So when we add to it the, let's say that when it gets cold and your tractor won't start and you can't feed the cattle or you can't get the kids on the school bus because it won't go in Unity, Oregon, because they won't start, you tend to look for somebody to blame, and this is a pretty handy situation. So it happens that I did talk to, I think it was the executive director of the Biodiesel Association of America out of, I want to say Missouri, but I'm not sure where. He called me because he thought that Senator Farioli and I were giving biodiesel a bad name by asserting that possibly it was causing these difficulties in starting these pieces of equipment in cold weather. After an hour of listening to him, it was apparent that there's nothing wrong with biodiesel, the bioelement of it. It all has to do with the mixture of it. So I anticipate that in Ontario, at least, we will soon have appropriately mixed biodiesel. It'll be more expensive, and the people will buy it because that's going to be, I think, one of the sole sources of this particular fuel. I did learn in that conversation that biodiesel clouds at 10 degrees below zero, which is sooner than other types of diesel. And so if it's not mixed appropriately, there will be a problem. That was the sole thing I got out of that discussion, because I am not a chemist. And I would just say that I would have appreciated this bill a year ago, but I would very much appreciate your support of this bill for this 1 year so we can kind of get our mixture process sorted out and then move forward as people become more familiar with how to get along with our new law.
Thank you, Representative Benson. The 1 year references to the Dash 1 amendments, which do several things, but one of them is to essentially sunset the provision on March 1st, 2011, allowing one winter for us to experiment with permitting blending in order to address the gelling concerns. I don't think there is anything further for Mr. Henderson. Representative Smith?
Yes, something quickly. It might be valuable to track whatever we can do to sort of track some of the complaints, et cetera, because I want to make sure we're putting the burden where it lie. And I think Representative Bailey's question was apropos I don't know what breakdown rates were, stall rates were prior to institution of the law, and I don't know what they are now, and maybe they're increased, and maybe they're not, and maybe they're increased a lot, maybe they're increased a little. To the extent we can get any data on that side, it's helpful, just as we think, as we come out of this, to think about, what's the scope of the problem.
Yeah, Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, we do track complaints and have a pretty good understanding of what the issues are when they...
Yeah, yeah.
And in previous winters, when some parts of the state hit a cold snap in the negative 10 to negative 25 range, what sort of complaints did you find then before our 2% biodiesel standard? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, Chair Cannon and Representative Smith, I'm not sure we had any regarding this particular issue. I think in Eastern Oregon, when it got that cold, people... I think people were more aware, given the mandate, and who to call, frankly.
Right.
Great.
Okay. Let's hear from... thank you, Mr. Henderson. Let's hear from Bob Russell, Paul Romaine, and I called Devin Diaz. He's on the sign-up sheet. If he's here, he's... Representative Boone?
Yeah. I'm just concerned about, in that this winter is a little weird already, and I don't know about over on the east side, but if the temperatures are lower for a winter, for that small period of time, we won't get a good picture of what the problem might really be. I've always thought sunsets were a little more, like at least 2 years, but often more. But just to get if you're going to do an average and a range, because with El Nino the way it is, I don't know what it's like on the east side, but on the coast, we're having some extremely warm right. weather this summer or this right. winter.
Our current witnesses may be able to speak to the notion of a one-year period in which to allow some flexibility. Go ahead, Mr. Irwin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association, and I'm here in support of the bill. First of all, we want to thank the chair for actually convening a work group first day of special session to address the problem and getting everybody together to see if there was a solution, and then drafting up 3693. The problem, we believe, is blending. It's not biodiesel. And what we're trying to do is figure out how to get it right. The problem in eastern Oregon and other parts of the state, or mainly eastern Oregon, is there, as Representative Benz pointed out, there is no blending facility. We're building one. One of my clients is building one out there, and our members of the association is building the plant, and that will take care of a certain portion of the state. But we do what's called splash blending, which is basically you take two different products and you throw them together and you hope they mix. And if you happen to throw them together at the wrong temperature, they're not going to mix and you could have basically separation. It's just not going to work. So blending is the key element. We are working with the trucking associations and we're going to put together a blending conference this summer to try and educate people about the proper ways to do blending if you're doing splash blending or other things is one way to help solve the problem. But the problem is real. We have gelling, we have problems with the fuel, and we need time to solve the problem. We don't want to go away from biodiesel. We are not asking you to go away from biodiesel. We have, again, people that have heavily invested in biodiesel. The one-year sunset is intentional because we want to get through next winter without having people, cars breaking down or trucks breaking down. You will be in session in 2011, and we can come back to you and say, with maybe a little more knowledge, we need to do X, Y, or Z if any change in the law is needed. We just think it's a practical way to go. Well, I want to make it clear, and we were hoping the Department of Ag would put on the record that those who can blend other things into the biodiesel include out-of-state refiners, and we need to make sure that's on the record because they're considered wholesalers under the law. And maybe if Department of Ag could come up and reiterate that, that would make somebody in the audience have a little higher comfort level. Practically speaking, when diesel, cold weather, you didn't have a problem blending stuff into it. You could take number one diesel, which is kerosene, basically. You could take that and blend it in, and you weren't going below some threshold. The problem now is if you have B2 and you put something in it, like 30% number one diesel, you've now gone below 2%. You may be at 1.3% or 50%, then you're down at 1% biodiesel. So you have violated the law. Department of Ag was very practical this winter. They basically said, as the complaints came in, we're not the bio police, make it work. And so most everybody just tried to make it work, and we appreciate their flexibility on that because, frankly, we were violating the law if you didn't have 2% biodiesel. We think this is an excellent solution, and we appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Romaine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. By going in reverse order, for once, I have very little to add to the conversation. Although I
that
would
was
like
intentional.
He just thought I was going to be last, and you'd be able to talk.
Although I would like to put on the record that my members did experience problems during the December cold snap, and with gelling and the fuel and those kinds of things. I would also like to say that the Oregon Trucking Association is not opposing the renewable fuel standard. We just appreciate the chair and the committee administrator and the committee recognizing that truly we have a problem, and I think this is a very reasonable solution to that problem with the Dash One amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
One other thing I just want to put on the record, that we were worried that Representative Jensen would have to break out his bottle of bourbon or scotch and pour it into the tank, and we don't want to have to worry about doing that next
Representative Jensen. Yeah, Representative Jensen, I really appreciate your concern in that regard. It kind of winds up being an expensive blend.
Sometimes necessary.
Representative Barnhart.
Isn't it true that even in Representative Jensen's whiskey, there's still too much water to be added to this fuel?
No.
Perhaps he has a special blend I don't know about.
Great. Thank you both very much. I will ask the department to come back up to address this question of whether or not out-of-state refiners are defined as wholesalers. And this refers to the provision in the bill, and I'm looking at the amendments, page 1, line 4, and then again line 13. I think that's concerned to ensure that an out-of-state refiner would, in fact, be permitted to offer this blended fuel under the bill that we're considering.
Yeah, for the record, again, Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Chair Cannon, it's our understanding, and I'm going to put a caveat on this, that I have not run this by the Department of Justice, but our past history is that the refineries, in-state, out-of-state, we don't have any in-state, but are included under the wholesale dealer definition by statute. And that means any person engaged in the sale of, and it says gasoline in this case, if the seller knows or has reasonable cause to believe the buyer intends to resell the gasoline in the same or an altered form to another, that's where we have categorized refiners.
And where, what are you reading from?
It's the statute. It's ORS 646905.
Great. Thank you. With that, is there any further public testimony on House Bill 3693? It appears not. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3693. I think in the interest of good process, I would like to hold over this work session until Thursday, just in case, since this has only been on an agenda since last Friday, just to give a bit of extra notice in case anyone else should come out of the woodwork on this issue. Obviously, that isn't always the case, and we do have a Thursday deadline to move House bills. So I will open a work session on House Bill 3693, but only to say that we will carry it over until Thursday, and my intention, committee, is that we would move this bill on Thursday. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3693 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3701. And Department of Ag will have testimony from the department on this committee bill, which is related to modification to the fuel burning ban that we passed last session. And again, it's the first testimony that we've heard on this issue as well. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Cannon, members of the committee. Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture, and with me is John Byers, our Smoke Management Program Director. We're going to just provide you a little bit of background and a map to help you understand kind of the conundrum that was developed based on the passage of Senate Bill 528 last session that phased out fuel burning in most of the Willamette Valley for calendar year 2010. In this map, there were about 11 fields that equal about 230 acres of identified species. And if you remember back to that legislation in Senate Bill 528, it allowed for the continuation of thermal sanitization of identified species in certain areas of the state. In the map, there was an area that somehow became part of the exclusionary. It's the little triangle, the darker green color, is yellow under the passage of Senate Bill 528. This bill would simply bring that triangle or thumb, as we have referred to it in the Department of Agriculture, about 11 fields of identified species into the area that would be allowed to burn in the coming years. And that's as simple as it is. It moves a boundary down and includes those 231 acres into the identified species.
Great. You have any prepared testimony or just here for questions?
Just to remind, John Byers, Department of Agriculture. I'm the program manager of the Smoke Management Program. To reiterate what Lisa had indicated, the 231 acres may not be stagnant. Farmers burn different fields, different years. So the fields you see on that map may change slightly, up or down by 100 acres, but I wouldn't anticipate it being much more than that.
Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the top of, I think, page 2 of the bill, which includes existing language. And I just want to make certain I understand what the rule is and what we're changing. I think what this statute says is that the acreage that can be burned on steep terrains and species identified can't exceed 15,000 acres a year.
That's correct.
How many acres are in the area that this bill would allow to be burned altogether?
Chair Ken, Representative Barnhart, I don't know specifically how many acres, but as I just indicated, my anticipation would be you've got 231 acres now. It would be 150 acres more of potential that could be burned. But as you indicated, the maximum of 15,000 acres is stagnant. That will be the total burn. So we're just adding a few more acres to the pool of what could be burned in the area that can be burned, as statute indicates.
Well, I still don't understand. Is it our expectation that there will be 15,000 acres burned every year?
Absolutely. Not that I would anticipate. Historically, it's between 13,000 and 14,000 acres, and that's been that way for the last number of years. So we will not exceed that 15,000 acres, and it would be anticipated that we most likely wouldn't burn more than 14,000.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. I'm just curious as to how this got left out in the first place.
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, the department feels that this, as to our knowledge, was an inadvertent issue that happened in drafting. When the bill was drafted, about the same time there were fields being registered, we were never asked for a list of where the fields were registered and, you know, for those exact boundaries. And so when we came around to burning season in 2009, there was this area that was in the exclusionary zone that were identified species or steep terrain that could have been. We were able to accommodate them for 2009 under regular acres to make it work, but that accommodation in 2010 would no longer be available because of the exclusionary zone.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions? The department, stick around in case anything comes up. Let's have Katie Fast return to the dais.
Good morning once again. Katie Fast, the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau is in support of 3701. I do have to say on the record that we entered this session hoping to have a comprehensive discussion around some other changes to the field burning legislation. This is the only piece that came forward, but it is a significant piece for the owners of those 11 fields. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Would you want to share what other pieces you were looking at?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, our members have concerns related to the ban of straw, stacks of straw. There is a market for straw right now. However, if you get adverse weather that comes in while those stacks of straw have not moved off your field, that
they're no longer marketable, and there is a concern within the industry and within our some of our members that they're left with the potential of having, you know, many tons of straw that they cannot move. Additionally, they would also like to have a time frame that if the EQC would move in and ban field burning by rule, which is allowable in the statute, that would be done by a date certain. And so farmers would have some management opportunity and some time to make decisions, and it wouldn't be a date certain in the middle of burning season, and farmers weren't able to change their management due to the rules and regulations.
Good follow-up. And where are we on the project that there was money appropriated for to use that straw?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, unfortunately there is a delay in that project. I'm probably not the person most up to speed on it, but it's my understanding that the biomass plant that's with some funding moved forward in the Junction City area to take some of the straw, that there are some endangered species issues with the site, and they're having to do some environmental impact statements that are delaying the construction of that site. And so that would add on to the concern with movement of straw, because if it's unmarketable, that was one place that there was some potential to take it to, that we're seeing a delay on its construction.
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay.
So likewise with this bill, I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on 3701, but only for the purpose of carrying it over to Thursday. It looks like we have all the paperwork on it, so should we choose to do so, we will move it onto the House floor in work session on Thursday. Close the work session on House Bill 3701. Open a work session on House Bill 3602. Members were not in a position to move this bill yet. We don't have completed paperwork. We just got an amendment, Representative Jensen. So we're still, if this amendment works, we'll still need our fiscal and revenue statements on that. But perhaps we could get an update on progress since we last spoke. A quick update on 3602.
Martha
Pagel. Yeah, come on up.
Oh, yeah, this is that one.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Martha Pagel, an attorney representing Umatilla County, and spoke to you last week at your hearing on the bill. Since that hearing, we have formed a work group of those who expressed an interest and had some concerns about the bill. We've made a tremendous amount of progress, and amendments have been prepared to reflect a conceptual consensus agreement among our work group members. We haven't had a chance to review all the wording, and I expect there'll be a little bit of refinement that we need to go through, but we understand you have to be ready to move on Thursday, so that's our plan, and we'll get back together. But I'm really very pleased to report the consensus among our group members and just a tremendous effort that the interested parties put in on this bill.
Okay, I'm not seeing any shaking heads behind you, so I will assume that that is the general perception of members who participated in the work group, and we'll look forward to hearing people's sort of final thoughts on this on Thursday. Any questions, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick perusal of this four-page amendment makes it appear as though the amendment actually narrows the bill somewhat. Is that the Chair's interpretation of it?
Like you, Representative Barnhart, I just received the amendment. That's certainly my impression of the intent of the amendment based on the conversations that I've had with members of the work group.
So, Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, one of the key points that the group focused on was narrowing the scope of the amendment. So really, as to our knowledge, it applies to this project. Another point that it does is strengthen and increase the requirements for fish screening and fish passage to bring it up to current standards, and also subordinates the use to the existing in-stream water right. Those were all issues that were testified to last week. But it is very narrow in scope and includes a sunset.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Bertram. And it avoids the possible problem of making it apply to a project that we didn't intend to apply it to.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to explain to the committee that the amendments came out yesterday afternoon. And, in fact, I didn't have an opportunity to pick them up until after 5 o'clock, at which time it was a little difficult to get circulation to. If I had had staff around, I might have been able to get it on circulation through your computer, but I didn't have any staff around, and I therefore avoided trying to mess up all your computers. So my apologies for that, but there really was very little we could do. That was the time frame that council gave us to work with.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. I appreciate the fact that we got the amendments today. It puts us, I think, in good shape, potentially at least, to move this bill on Thursday, which is coming up very quickly. Any other questions for Martha? I guess, not for now, but maybe when we return to this issue with a little bit more time on Thursday, I'm still interested in the question I don't think was answered in our previous testimony about the rationale in the existing law for the revocation of a license when a project's forfeited to a county or municipal corporation. It's there, and we only want to deal with it. We're being careful not to sort of overturn that existing law, so we must. It must have some purpose and some rationale, and I don't know, Martha, if you have a thought on this now, or we can hear from others.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that the Water Resources Department will be preparing something for you. I spoke with the director last week, but just my understanding from working with the staff and my working knowledge of these statutes over the last 20 years or so is that the reason that existed in the first place was that the statutes have historically included two tracks. If you are a municipal corporation, basically a city, there's a process to apply for a water right for a hydroelectric project that is like other water rights in that it is perpetual. It has the potential to be perpetual and not have a time limit on it. For everybody else who applies for a water right for hydroelectric process, there's a time limit. And I think this statute was intended to cancel out the existing private time-limited water right and allow then the city, the municipal corporation, to come in and apply for the water right that would be in perpetuity. But since that framework was established many years ago, everything else has changed, so it is no longer really an advantage for a city to have to come in and reapply. It is far better for them to be able to continue operating the existing project. But we also see that this fact situation just doesn't arise very often, where either by a voluntary, like a condemnation proceeding, or involuntary through foreclosure, that a government body would acquire the project.
Thanks. That's helpful. And maybe on Thursday we'll get the department back up one more time before we move on this issue and can hear from them again on that question. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll carry that bill over. That is House Bill 3602. Carry that over to Thursday as well and close the work session on House Bill 3602. Open a work session on House Bill 3606. This bill relates to electronics waste. And do we have there are some folks here to testify, including at least one who has not testified previously. We are in work session, so it will be invited testimony. But let's begin. Beth, where do we stand with this in terms of amendments, paperwork?
The department's been working on a set of amendments. They're not quite there yet, but Palmer Mason is here from the department, and the program staff are here. They can update you on that.
Palmer, will you, Loretta as well, would you come up and update us on where we stand on that?
Good morning, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me Loretta Pickerell, who is our manager of solid waste policy and development at DEQ. The amendment for House Bill 3606 is, I think, close to completion. We submitted it to Legislative Council on Friday. We were asked some questions on yesterday that we're going to follow up on. I would characterize those questions as clarifying. They don't really have much to do per se with the substance of the amendment. They're just making sure the wording is right in terms of making sure the amendment says what it's intended to say, as well as making sure the amendment conforms to the rest of the statute. So there's probably like four or five questions that we need to work with Legislative Council on. But again, I don't think any of them are substantive, and hopefully with Beth's help, you know, over the next day, we'll definitely get that completed.
Kim? Anything further? We'll look forward to seeing those amendments. And committee, just so I don't know if anything can be clear about this bill, but the amendments would move the responsibility for television manufacturers to market share sort of across the board, make that consistent in how responsibilities are assigned throughout the program. So there were kind of several different possibilities that we looked at, and that was what the Justin Martin, who represented Thompson, was advocating. That's what the department finds, believes would, I think, improve the program, one of several possibilities that would improve the program. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Palmer, I just have a quick question for you, too. And this is kind of maybe off the current subject, but is the recycling program, the e-recycle, does that include electronic typewriters?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, no, it does not. It only includes TVs, monitors, and laptops. Okay. So it does not include electronic typewriters.
Is there a follow-up? Is there any way for people? I've been getting questions about this as people, you know, have found them in their attics or whatever, and they are electronic, and they, you know, have some. They're old, but what do they do with them?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, and I'm looking at Loretta. I think we can certainly try to help you find some opportunity to recycle that. Although a suggestion, it might be valuable enough to put on eBay. You never know. An old enough typewriter, actually. And we'll follow up with that. And I think also Metro, sometimes if you're in the Metro area, you can call their hotline, and they're very good about telling people what to do for recycling products.
It was something I hadn't considered, and somebody called me and said, what do I do with my big honking electronic?
But if I may, I mean, if you could put it on eBay, it's going to be either reused or kept rather than recycled, so that might be a good solution.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Seeing nothing further, thank you very much. Thanks, Loretta. And we have, you're here to testify on this bill as well.
Yeah,
come on up and introduce yourself for the record.
They're actually typewriter, electronic typewriter.
I have a set of PowerPoints. I don't know if you want to see them.
Do you have printouts, or you actually have PowerPoint slides?
Actually, I have a computer here that I could do it.
We can do it. We may take a moment to set it up. Sue, would you be willing to help with that? Yeah, we're happy to. Yeah, let's stand in recess for a moment while we set up the PowerPoint. Thank you. call the committee back to order. We are in work session on House Bill 3606, and we have a visitor. And we want to give you the opportunity to testify. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, and then we only have about 15 minutes to spend on this issue today. So
okay.
We'll need to keep it pretty brief.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairman. I'm Mike Moss from Samsung Electronics, and I want to tell you a little bit about our particular situation in Oregon with the upcoming potential change. What I kind of want to do as an outline is, first of all, I fully recognize diverse opinions, and I'm very familiar with e-waste issues, market share, return share, and all that kind of stuff. What I'm going to try to do is erase the issue of market share versus return share as being a primary motivator for what I'm trying to accomplish, which is opposition to SB 3606. So I will work through this, and I will focus on our particular hardship as I see it. And thank you very much. Okay, Samsung began a very intense recycling program as of about a year and a half ago. And it took several years to develop, and it was developed through years of trying to work with the industry and develop a program that worked for everybody and brought everybody together. But it didn't work out like that, so eventually we just took it upon ourselves to build our own program. The program we have is national. It's based on the highest industry standards, highest industry principles. We have a strong investment. Last year we recycled a lot of this voluntarily, more e-waste than any other company out there. We're absolutely committed. We're not afraid to step away from handling e-waste. We're an industry partner. We seek a balanced approach with industry, as I mentioned, and we're also relevant. If you measure us by one person speaking in front of you, or by 20% market share, or 4% market share, and so forth and so on, jobs created and so forth, I think Samsung is very relevant. Now, market share versus return share. I think that, Samsung does not promote market share over return share, or vice versa. That's not our issue. Both finance systems are equally laden with benefits and detriments. Both systems bring along winners and losers. Overall, there's no effective net industry benefit in Oregon to shifting a whole system from return share to market share, or vice versa, actually. Such a shift will similarly favor some and disfavor others. Initially, Samsung changed course from favoring state plan to an IP, to an independent plan. We did this based on the final regulation that was given to us, and in good faith and good spirit, we developed what we thought would be an advantage as given to us in terms of regulation. So Samsung smartly positioned for the future. We created key long-term relationships that we cannot walk away from. If the independent plan switches to market share, then our company is penalized due to our inflexibility because of relationships and increased relative cost. We did not anticipate a reversal. But I did anticipate that button would go to the next slide.
There you go.
Okay, there. Okay, here's a brief summary of points. Samsung is very content with the current law. Overall, there's no discernible, as we see it, net industry benefit, and you could argue this for 5 years as it's been going on so far. There's no absolute benefit to one system, return share or market share, as compared to the other. A shift will similarly favor some and disadvantage others. Samsung will be penalized by a shift from return share to market share due to our relationships and our inability to move back out of this relationship to a system that might be a lower price. Therefore, Samsung opposes any change in law. In other words, we support the current system it is, which it happens to be returned here. Recommendations are to hold steady with current law in Oregon. If the DEQ recommends to change state plan to return share, we can support that. And they've stated clearly that they would accept equally either a full return share system or a full market share system. This appears to be the most balanced solution, in my opinion, because of the current situation, causing the least penalty to existing programs. We're part of a independent plan program that was created in response to a law. And if we're forced to go to a market share, okay, that's going to give us a penalty. But the problem with the state's recycling is not the independent plans. It's the state's plan, not the people running it, obviously, but it's the state's plan because they're non-competitive, because they're based on market share. So they have to either become return share or along with the existing plans, which is preferable, or take everybody along with them and go to market share, which seems unreasonable. So I hope that clarifies our position. Independent producer responsibility is also kind of a future concept that I think we have to consider. It's not all about market share, return share, or what your financial benefits are one way or the other. It's about doing the best for the environment, and we have to find ways to bring people in the middle and get everybody to move together in unison as an industry. IPR, for example, would evolve more readily in the future, and it would take years, but it would evolve more readily in the future out of a return share system, because I'm projecting that over time, as recycling commoditizes, that generally speaking, collection and recycling infrastructures are going to merge. So we're going to have less, there's going to be some competition, but less competition. It's just going to be bigger volumes per respective infrastructure. And that's going to make it much easier for us to make a claim to our individual brands. And we will pay for, in that case, we will pay for our individual brands as opposed to our return share. And this benefits those companies like Samsung and a few other companies who are aggressively trying to make products that are more environmentally digestible, that are going to be easier to recycle in the future. That's just something to think about in the future. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to help.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Moss, for coming here today. And Representative Boone.
I have just a couple of questions. I didn't know what the acronyms were on the last slide, so the DFE.
Design for Environment.
Okay. And then follow up. With whom are the relationships that you referred?
In particular, there's a direct and probably several mini indirect. But the direct relationship I have with our recycler, URT, and Tom Pritchard is one of the people of who's I head of the EH&S Environmental Health and Safety for that organization. Our relationship with them has emerged and surged, and it's done so because they have the same fundamental values and principles as Samsung Electronics, and ours are based on the Ban Basel Amendment. We are the most diligent about protecting the export of e-waste to developing countries. Our principles won't allow any of that in terms of allowing for hazardous materials to go to developing countries and stuff like that. And we're the most, arguably the most, and I hope soon it will be clearly defined with our relationships with some other entities. but I think we're the most progressive about getting the job done in the right way according to the strongest principles.
Mr. Mouse, you said Samsung's market share is about 20%. Its return share, I think, is about 4%.
Yes.
Were those for Oregon or
more broadly? I would say that's a national average.
Okay, well, let's assume that Oregon looks something like that since you're obviously a national, international company. So you care, under the current law, you carry to your independent plan the obligation that for kind of pound collection at your return share. So you carry that 4% over to your company, your independent plan.
Yes.
And then costs among the manufacturers participating in that independent plan are allocated however you've agreed to allocate them. And we don't, the law doesn't prescribe what form you'll use to allocate those among the manufacturers participating in that plan. Under the bill, you would carry to whichever plan, a state plan or an independent plan, you would carry a 20%. 20% of the total pounds in the system would become your responsibility, and based on the market share approach. And as you pointed out, I think the concern that brought the bill forward is the fact that under the current law, we're using this sort of hybrid system for the state plan, where they bring their return share, but then they're allocated market share. And the intention, I mean, I have to sort of remind you, and I think remind the committee, that the intention of the 2007 legislation was to use market share. And we heard from the television manufacturers at the time, they much and strongly preferred market share to return share as the methodology for assigning costs responsibility for the program. And Samsung, what's Samsung's position been on this market share versus return share question nationally and in Oregon? Because I actually voted against. I voted for return share. I was in the minority. I was one of two members of the committee who voted for return share in 2007. But the majority of the committee agreed that it was market share, and it would appear to be just a mistake in the drafting of the 2007 law that we ended up with this hybrid where you bring your return share, but then in the state program that's allocated by market share. I believe that the legislature meant to use market share as the allocation methodology for television manufacturers, and I believe that's consistent with what we heard from television manufacturers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, a couple thoughts. First is that if market share is an issue, it goes both ways, and Samsung didn't speak up then, unfortunately, to represent the position of favoring return share, you know, if that's what we would have done. But part of that is because Samsung has been a company that has emerged from, the first time I heard of the company myself was during the 2000 Olympics or something like that. And we did not have a strong market share for televisions until just 5 years ago. So that also translates to our legislative efforts and our knowledge and skill to approach legislation. So we weren't there because I don't think we had the maturity level of a company to be there.
Okay. Seeing nothing further on this subject, I hope there's nothing further. I'm sure there will be by Thursday when we bring it back up again. I'm going to close the work session, carry over House Bill 3606, and close the work session on House Bill 3606. And open a work session on House Bill 3661. And members, I did not intend to move this bill forward today. I don't sense that there's the support on the committee to do so. I did open the work session, scheduled it for a work session, and opened the work session in order to give us a chance to talk about this issue, because we've had quite a bit of testimony on it. I've been hearing testimony on this issue since I joined the legislature and served on the Environment Committee in 2007. It obviously is one that raises strong feelings on a lot of people's part. And I'm very interested in where members are on this. I think while I think it's unlikely that we'll be moving a bill forward in this legislative session, it is very likely an issue that we will be hearing about again, whether we want to or not, and I would love to kind of get a sense of where members of this committee are on this groundwater exempt well issue. I know Representative Thompson had an amendment, and happy to talk about that, but again, sort of more broadly, I'm interested in what members are thinking as they consider this question of exempt wells, and to sort of open it up for conversation, not, you know, on a motion necessarily, but just on the issue of exempt wells. Representative Thompson?
I would support your inclination not to move this forward. I think it's a much larger issue than what this bill has included in it, and we're dangerously close to going off in the weeds on water policy and inciting water wars that are probably going to be incited anyway. But I'm not sure the short session is a time to do that.
Okay. Representative Bernhardt.
Mr. Chair, if I think I agree with that statement. I'm not certain that I do, but I think I do. if it were shown that we were facing some kind of an emergency that a bill like this would ameliorate, I'd probably have a different opinion. I think, I can't tell whether it's simply my lack of knowledge of this subject or whether it's simply that the knowledge hasn't been developed yet, that we need a better understanding of what the point of a bill like this is, what the purpose of it is. And then I have this sneaking suspicion that whatever plan we come up with, it will be dependent upon having an adequate system for oversight and enforcement. As resources get shorter, as aquifers get drawn down in some parts of the state where water is in short supply, the need of some system of allocation for fairness, or based on pre-existing rights, or some other categorization system to protect the economy and the people's abilities to live in their homes and those kind of things, become more and more acute. And I'm perfectly willing to, that the legislature should take up that kind of an issue. But at this point, what I have been seen is through such a small window that I can't tell whether anything like that's actually happening or not, or that this bill actually addresses that issue. So I think in that sense, I agree with Representative Thompson. If as I suspect, the key issue is a lack of resources for enforcement, then any amount of tinkering we do with the regulation isn't going to make a whole lot of difference. Unless the regulation is clearly inadequate, and we can actually reduce the cost of enforcement quite a lot by passing a new statute that does that makes it more rational, that sets it up in a way that's easier to enforce. I don't think anything's been shown on this bill, at least, that would accomplish that kind of purpose. And finally, if we're trying to deal with scarcity, let's make a statute that's specific to areas of scarcity. It may be perfectly reasonable to run water in a way that would be profligate and unreasonable in a scarce area in a place where there's plenty of water.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Yeah. On an issue like this, I'm reminded that I sort of wish we, from time to time, met at a circular table rather than these dime store thrones, so we could have conversation, discussion, rather than deliver many speeches. But I do want to say a couple things. I am not particularly interested or motivated to muck about with the current water uses and water allocations of people who've been holding water rights in our state for a long time. I am deeply concerned, although I'm a Johnny-come-lately to that concern, about what water use will look like 20 years from now. And I think we are, we don't have the tools, and we don't appear to have the tools to make the tools. And I'm not even sure at this point we have the will to make the tools, to address that question. A question that will, in its failure, lead to the failure of our own elections not once, but could lead to the failure of the next generation many times over. And I am very concerned about that and not sure how we're going to come to grips with that question. And I am appreciating the people who are at least asking us to consider it and that you are asking us to discuss it, because it could be one of the short list of biggest problems our Western world faces in the coming decades.
Mm-hmm. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I can just speak for myself, but I feel pretty inadequate to be making this kind of policy for areas of the state where I don't have a lot of experience. And in my part of the state, we have an overabundance of water. And
yeah.
I'm concerned also in this particular bill, the sense of fairness of applying limits on use of water both individually and to a group, where, for example, and it's not in my district, but down the coast, and we do have them in my district, but areas where people join together for a common use, common well, and they would be restricted as a group, whereas their neighbor might have their own well, and they would have the entire realm of the usage of the water, et cetera, for the same size of use, put it there, for acreage, et cetera. But what I'm trying to say is that you could have 10 families on this well, and they have the same allocation as one family on this well, and I didn't think that that was very fair. But I guess, finally, I believe that we have some great resources in our extension service and people who are much more professional in that area than I am, and maybe some of you also. But there are some people here from Representative Benson Jensen, in particular, from that part of the state where we're really talking about, who know far more than I do on that. But I will challenge them on their clam digging efforts. And I think that we can also, and not last but not least, take a lesson from the people themselves in these areas, who must, by virtue of the fact that they have limitations in their water, have to be very creative and innovative in how they use that water. And I have actually seen, not in Oregon, but in Yakima, some old friends from the seaside area moved up to some, their horse farmers or horse ranchers, and they would literally, by the clock, go out on their four-wheel drives and divert the water to hit the spot they wanted to, because they know they have X number of minutes of usage. I mean, it's down to an art in that area. And I think that people who have, they know their limits, they know what they have, and they figure out a way to use it to the best of their ability. And we can learn a lot from them in terms of, those are the real kings and queens of conservation that I know. And I was amazed at the using a small amount of water to maximize for their use for their animals and their home use and their yard. And in the middle of Yakima, which gets pretty darn hot in the summer, they had a garden growing, a very nice garden growing. And they used all sorts of capture, from rain to seepage to whatever. They reused their dishwater. They were the kings and queens of recycling in water usage. So my thought is that this does deserve more conversation in that sense, but I think that we need to keep all those things in mind. And I think that Representative Barnhart was the one who mentioned the fact of using applying it differently in different areas where the water is scarcer or not. And I think that Representative Thompson says it all, is it's a much bigger job to take on than we have in this. We've got one more day, basically, in this session. And we're seeing today, in light of, if I might just diverge just a tiny bit, all of the bills today we can't work because we don't have, it's been happening so fast, we don't have the paperwork even. It's happening in my other communities too. We are not able to finish, and I can see Thursday is everybody better be here and not be sick, because it's going to be a wild day to get through everything.
Yes.
So thanks for...
Very true.
Thank you for indulging
Representative Benz.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for asking to share our thoughts on this. I just scribbled down, in the 8 years I was on the Water Resource Commission, I scribbled down some of the challenges we faced around the state at Parrot Mountain, which many people have heard of, the sublimity out here at State in Mullala, Cow Valley, Bonanza, New River over on the coast, Hermiston, Boardman, Umatilla, Bend, Sisters, Metolius, Burns, Klamath Falls, Christmas Valley, Medford, Ashland, Jacksonville, and Lakeview are the ones I wrote down just as I was listening to your my other folks' remarks. Each one of those areas challenged in one way or another with water. The issue here is a mixture, or all of our issues with water are a mixture of engineering and hydrology and law, and then a huge level of paranoia. Paranoia is driven by the fear that someone's going to take away the water, which gives your land its value, and so instantly you're going to be dealing with this fear. And any time you're dealing with the kind of slicing and dicing that this bill engages in, you're going to encounter that kind of a very, very understandable response. So to me, this issue is going to be coming up in the strategic water planning exercise that was in the representative's bill, and I think that's a very good place for this discussion to occur. It's going to go on, I think, for a couple of years, and it deserves that kind of discussion. For us to come in here and to try to manage it in this short, it's just not possible, and I don't think we would do a good job of it. I understand everyone's concern, by the way, probably better than most. We fear we're going to let the demand system manage our water systems, and that's not a good... I've been there. I know all about water litigation. It's a horrid way of resolving issues. It's the worst possible way. So we all want to trend toward planning, but the planning effort is hugely expensive and hugely difficult. Just look at Bend. Look at all the challenges of figuring out how much water is under that volcanically fractured ground. So to me, treading cautiously and carefully is the most important thing, and I very much appreciate the Chair's thought that this bill deserves more discussion.
Well, I want to say a few words. I agree with a lot of what's been said, and certainly Representative Barnhart, the need for additional resources for enforcement. The fact is that without additional resources for the department, it matters very little what we would do to change the law with respect to groundwater uses, exempt uses. And yes, to the need for additional innovation and learning from the water users with respect to conservation. There's a lot that we can be doing. Mr. Kosasin's suggestions with respect to a water conservation program as a way of holding on to gallons, I think makes a lot of sense. As far as the rationale for looking at the exempt well statute, I mean, I think it's pretty simple, in fact. Although water law is very, very complicated, the rationale for this bill and for these changes is actually pretty simple, and a lot of that has been clouded by some of the testimony that we've received. The issue arose for me in 2007 and again in 2009 when I believe both the Farm Bureau and the Nursery Association, along with conservation groups like Water Watch and League of Women Voters, Central Oregon Land Watch, came and said, we've got a problem with the proliferation of these wells. And from a nursery's standpoint, from some farmer's standpoint, at least at the time, unfortunately they've been silent this session, but in the past sessions they've said, we're concerned about the wells, the permitted wells that we use to irrigate our fields. And we're looking at the development proliferation of home sites, especially in the valley, that are having an effect on aquifers and the aquifers that we depend on for our growing operations. So concern about declining aquifers, concern about the effect that the proliferation of exempt wells has on those declining aquifers, and then a statute that says that exempt well owners are allowed to withdraw 15,000 gallons per day. And I remind folks that Water Resources Department said in testimony in this committee, and they're here to correct me if I'm mischaracterizing their statement,
that they cannot theoretically imagine a beneficial use of more than 5,000 gallons per day. So why does our statute permit 15,000 gallons per day? The department says, and I don't think we've heard, well, I won't say that, but I have not heard convincing rebuttal that anyone could beneficially use more than 5,000 gallons per day. So why does the statute permit 15,000 gallons per day? So in fact, I think this bill is pretty simple, and it is an eminently sensible thing, particularly given the shortage of resources, the cash-strapped nature of this department, the fact that it has to use pretty blunt tools when it gets out there and tries to adjudicate water conflicts. It doesn't have the ability to spend days trying to determine whether or not water is being used beneficially before it regulates. It makes a lot of sense to give them a tool like the blunt 5,000 gallons per day, which no one can beneficially use more than 5,000 gallons per day for domestic and lawn and garden purposes. I think this bill is simple. I think it's sensible. I understand that in this short session, at this particular moment in time, it may not be the right time place to get this done. And frankly, I think even if we were to pass it, I don't think anyone has claimed that it would have some sort of magnificent effect on the restoration of aquifers. But I do believe, I agree very strongly with Representative Smith, that our failure to address this issue going forward would not have necessarily significant consequences for us and our political futures, but will have a very significant effect on the livelihood of Oregonians generations hence. So I hope we do return to this subject in future sessions. I suspect that we will, and hope that the folks who have been involved will continue to remain involved and work with members of this committee and other committees to better understand this issue. It can become extraordinarily complicated, but better understand this issue in order to take it up again in some form in 2011. So with that, I will close the Representative Jensen. You are determined to have the final word.
No.
And out of my great respect for you, sir, I will allow you to have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I wasn't determined to have the final word. I was perfectly willing to precede you.
Ah, well.
And I thought you recognized my hand up. If it is the final word, so be it. And in fact, your testimony complicates what I was going to say.
Good.
In some because I was going to agree with almost everyone else and their statements and observations. Make one point, and I think it was alluded to already, but those of you who sat on the subcommittee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources last session, during the regular session, will recall that the Water Resource Department budget was one of a great concern, and primarily because Water Resource Department budget out of in the historical past has relied more on general fund money than some of the other natural resource agencies. And with the situation we find ourselves in now, and the situation we found ourselves in during the last session, except there was no general fund resource available for us, and the Water Resource Department was scheduled, according to the mandates coming down from the leadership and the co-chairs of the Ways and Means, for some excruciating reductions. And those reductions would have resulted, in my opinion, in a significant damage to the viability of the Water Resource Department. And so we went and took a step that many of my colleagues on my side of the aisle didn't even support and voted against us on the floor, with the increase in fees to the Water Resource Department, or to the users of the resource. and I understand, you know, where they were coming from, and I also understand what I thought was the challenge that we had as far as the agency was concerned and the need to keep the agency in a situation where they could do their existing job. I think failure to do that would result in some complications that that you're fearing, I believe, Mr. Chair, somewhere down the road. I don't know whether it'll be, you know, if we put it in your lifetime, maybe in my lifetime probably makes little or no difference, sort of thing. But somewhere down the road there, if that agency hadn't, you know, we would, I think, had significant problems. One of the things I see, one of the concerns that I would have with the proposed legislation is that it would further complicate the budget issue as far as the agency is concerned. And I would like to find some way to be able to resolve some of the budget situations. We all will recall that we did put a sunset on those fees, primarily because I thought that the legislature needed the time to seriously look at how we're going to fund the Water Resource Department and who is going to be responsible for paying. You know, for those funds. And I think you all were, you know, as far as I can tell, everybody was in pretty much agreement on those points. And so without without repeating, you know, much of what has been said here, all of it I agree with, and even though it's sometimes difficult for me to do, Mr. Chair, I would even have to admit that there are portions of what you had to say that I would agree with. Whether I want to put those specifically on the record might be another point. And you all remember the motto that we had a few years ago on the water resource or in the water committee. You know, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, and that's still true. We still have a lot of really severe issues to deal with. I think the next world wars may be over water, not over oil, because oil becomes redundant when you run out of water, and we. We are learning a lot. We do a lot of great things in terms of conservation now. Although I think Representative Bentz probably could speak better to this than I can, but one of the great conservation issues has been maybe to do away with flood irrigating and instead of using the circles or drip irrigation or something of that nature, both of which are more expensive in a lot of ways. But use much less water to do the same job. However, we've lost some of the return flows to the rivers that cause a lot of people some concern and consternation when we don't do flood irrigation because that water that was in excess of what the crops were using in a lot of cases wound up going back into the rivers to provide for in-stream benefits, if you wish, for them. And those are challenges that conservation remains for us. And these are topics, I guess, way beyond the scope of exempt or exempt wells. And I'll just conclude saying I genuinely appreciate the discussion that's taken place here this morning. I appreciate your positions, Mr. Chair, and those of everyone else who has spoken on this issue. One of the things that is encouraging to me, there's been more interest generated in the last few years, and some of you who follow the legislature have been here for 100 years, more or less. Might see it a little differently than I do, but there's been more interest in this issue of water on the part of members in the House than there was when, at least I perceived that there was when I first got here. And I think it's going to take a continuation of that interest on both sides of the aisle. And in spite of the fact that Representative Bernhardt may have resented having to learn something about water and water law, it's good for his soul, if nothing else, that he's had to do that, you know. And it's good for everybody in the legislature to have more interest in that, because it is a major problem of the future.
Appreciate Representative Jensen those remarks and your fine work on this issue, and particularly in the last session dealing with the and finding a really brave path forward for the department with respect to its funding, as well as the work that you did with Representative Smith on the Umatilla and the integrated water strategies issue that is beginning to bear fruit. So thank you. Thank you very much. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3661. Beth, am I forgetting anything?
No.
Okay. With that, we'll close the House Committee on Environment and Water. 15 minutes are